Morning, everyone. Thanks for coming up for the second day. We're going to be running straight from the first panel this morning into the final round table at 12 o'clock. And then lunch will be here at 1 o'clock for those of you who want to have lunch as soon as possible and then head off. So this morning, we are going to be hearing, first of all, from Jessica Pearson, who is an assistant professor at McAllister College in St. Paul. And Jessica's work focuses on the intersection between colonial and global health, mainly in French Africa.
Thanks, Dave. So I did circulate a paper, which I'm not going to read. Presumably, either read it or you didn't. But I'm just going to talk a little bit about my book more generally and how it fits in with the topic of the workshop. So I'm going to talk about colonial outsiders and international public health. The title of my book provisionally is The Colonial Politics of Global Health, France and the United Nations in Post-War Africa. And the question that I set out to study in the book is, why did France, which was a country that had been so plugged into the international public health scene from the very beginning, try so hard to keep the World Health Organization out of its African empire? So when I was starting to look at the work of the different regional offices of the WHO in the late 1940s and early 1950s, when I was sort of at the very beginning of my research, I was confused why the Africa region, which seemed to be one of the regions most desperately in need of international health investment, seemed to have sort of fallen by the wayside, especially when you compare it to other regions like Southeast Asia and the Americas. And what I ended up finding, and what I ultimately argue in the book, is that It was the broader context of evolving international colonial oversight at the United Nations at this moment of decolonization that really created a situation in which the French perceived any international involvement in their African empire as a threat to French colonial sovereignty. So they were really afraid that international personnel working for the WHO would report back to the UN on conditions in the colonies, specifically health conditions, and that anti-colonial delegations to the UN would then use that information as fodder for their sort of anti-colonial position at the UN. So they were afraid sort of the WHO serving as kind of a de facto visiting mission to the colonies. They were also afraid that international personnel working in the colonies would start dialogues with Africans about self-determination and sort of broader debates about empire at the UN. So when I sat down to think about this theme of outsiders to the workshop, I remember I was sitting at a coffee shop and I had this whole list of, like, I was brainstorming, like, who are the outsiders in this story? And I ended up with a whole sheet, and then when I was done, I thought, well, you know, who isn't an outsider in this story? But I want to talk about sort of three specifically, or I'm going to mention three, and I'm going to talk about two. So the first group of outsiders in the story are French colonial health administrators and doctors. And I wanted to think about this group as outsiders at the WHO. And I was thinking about this yesterday when Dave was presenting, and thinking about how this is different from Spain. So it sounded like Spain wanted to no longer be an outsider, and they wanted to join in the WHO. And, you know, this is an interesting comparison to French colonial doctors who, instead of being outsiders wanting to be insiders, they're insiders wanting this particular slice of their existence to be outside, right? And so keeping the WHO from becoming too involved in France's African empire was a way to protect the French empire from unwanted international criticism. So this is very much a group of people who want to be outsiders, at least in a kind of particular piece. So the second outsider that I thought of was, I tried to think about the World Health Organization as an outsider in French Africa. And I'm going to say a little bit more about this in a few minutes, but as I'm sure many people in this room know, the World Health Organization's Africa office ends up getting set up in Brazzaville, which is the capital of French Equatorial Africa. And what I argue in the book is that even though it's there in one of France's most important African colonies, the WHO Regional Office for Africa never loses its outsider status, even after it gets set up in Brazzaville. So the French mentality behind inviting the WHO to set up shop there was this keep your friends close and keep your enemies closer mentality. And as soon as the office is established, French colonial bureaucrats and French doctors try to keep the office from really doing anything at all. And I'll elaborate on that in a little bit. And then the last group of outsiders, and this is a group that I don't talk very much about in the book, mostly as a function of the way that I did the research. I didn't do any oral history interviews. I mostly used colonial archives. So, you know, I would especially welcome in the question and answer period, and if anyone has thoughts about how I could incorporate this into the book more. But the last group of outsiders, and perhaps the ultimate outsiders, are Africans themselves, right? And this is something that I thought a lot about during the 2014-2015 Ebola epidemic, that there is some sort of longer legacy of this tension between the French Colonial Health Administration and the WHO. In many ways, Africans are still outsiders in the World Health Organization. Okay, so I'm really going to focus on these first two pieces. So the French Empire as an outsider at the WHO, and then the WHO as an outsider in the French Empire. So, you know, as many of us know, as historians of public health, French doctors and French government officials had always been extremely engaged in the field of international public health. Paris is the site of the first International Sanitary Conference in 1851. It serves as the headquarters for the International Office of Public Hygiene. And at some point in 1946, during the International Health Conference, the French delegation actually proposes Paris as a potential headquarters for the WHO. As I said in my introduction, though, there's this sort of particular slice of French existence that the French want to keep separate from the WHO, and that is their African empire. So when I was beginning my archival research, this book grew out of my dissertation that I finished in 2013. The sort of first piece of research that I did was really looking at health conditions on the ground in sort of France's two African federations, so French West Africa and French Equatorial Africa. And I just want to read a quote from 1946 from the health director in Guinea that I think really sums up sort of the lay of the land of public health in Francophone Africa right after the war. So this is from 1946, and this is the report from Guinea on the previous year. So the medical director wrote, "In 1939, the situation wasn't brilliant. At the beginning of 1946, it was catastrophic. This situation urgently calls for, on the part of public powers, a complete overhaul of the colonial health system based on a freer, more flexible, and more efficient foundation. The native population is wasting away, disappearing. Our doctors are ready. Give them arms." So I spent about 4 months looking over 15 years of reports from each one of France's sub-Saharan African territories, and I see this sort of same theme again and again and again, that there's sort of the impetus for reform is there, but there's either a lack of funds or a lack of willpower on the part of the people that are going to have to carry out these reforms. So despite this extremely dire situation in the field of public health, a situation which I argue actually jeopardized the very legitimacy of the colonial project, if empire is all about, you know, this, for the French, the civilizing mission, this idea that you're providing hospitals and railroads and schools when you actually can't provide those things, and this is a moment where people in the French Empire actually get citizenship, it starts to look like, you know, maybe you're not able to deliver on some of the promises that you've made. It was very interesting to me that the French seemed so unwilling to engage with new international health organizations like the WHO. So the question I wanted to ask is why? So why did the French insist on remaining outsiders in a system that they had worked hard to help create over the course of about 100 years? And what kind of threat did they perceive that the WHO actually posed to France's colonial empire? I think, Dave, when you were talking about the creation of the WHO yesterday, one of the things that they really claimed was that this was supposed to be an apolitical organization, right? So why is this something that's perceived to be such a threat? So I traced the answer to this question back to another international body, the United Nations. And the organization I specifically look at is called, I think in very classic UN fashion, the United Nations Special Committee on Information Transmitted from Non-Self-Governing Territories. So this is the committee that's charged with collecting all of the reports from colonies that didn't fall under the UN trusteeship system. So they collect reports on three different areas: so economic development, education, and social policy. And social policy included health. The committee was expressly forbidden from soliciting information of a political nature. So what ended up happening was that discussions about school infrastructure, agricultural policy, malaria eradication, infant and maternal health clinics, these all became sort of very thinly veiled debates about the legitimacy of colonial rule. So anti-colonial delegations at the UN, delegations from Latin America, South Asia, the Middle East, the Soviet Union, used this information to make claims about the sort of broader structural inequalities that were inherent in the way that colonial empires were governed. So anti-colonial delegations pointed to various shortcomings in colonial public health. So low per capita expenditures, high rates of infant mortality, shortages of medical personnel, and insufficient hospital access. And they accused colonial governments of overemphasizing future plans in their reports and not accurately reporting on the situation that was actually on the ground. Colonial delegations responded that it was unfair to compare dependent territories to their more developed metropolitan counterparts. They claimed instead that health conditions should be compared to those in independent territories that were at a similar stage of social and economic development. So the French would say, you know, it's not fair to compare Dakar and Paris. You should really be comparing Bolivia and Senegal, that would be a more accurate comparison. The Belgians said that, you know, many of the shortcomings of colonial public health had less to do with their status as colonial territories than with a sort of general lack of financial resources that all countries were experiencing in the wake of the war. And then the British delegation said that the shortage of medical personnel was common in many countries and was not necessarily a bigger problem for colonial territories. The French delegation also claimed that it should be given more credit for the progress it had made in health, so extensive campaigns to fight yellow fever, malaria, and sleeping sickness, and that's what should be emphasized instead of making these unfair comparisons between Africa and continental Europe. So while the French Colonial Health Administration desperately wanted funding for projects that they had envisioned during the war, as many people in this room know, what the WHO had to offer was primarily technical assistance in the form of experts and not cash. And it was sort of the sticking point for France. So they wanted funds, but they didn't want international personnel to actually come and work on the ground in Africa. And you know, as I said earlier, they were sort of afraid that these people would then be able to report back to the UN about what they were seeing. So the special committee was not allowed to do two things that the trusteeship council could do. So the trusteeship council can send to trust territories visiting missions to observe conditions on the ground. And the trusteeship council can also hear petitions from people living in trust territories. And the special committee can't do that for other kinds of colonial territories. So the French are really thinking that these different UN technical agencies are going to become an important conduit between Africans and the UN that didn't otherwise exist. Okay, so when this question of creating an Africa office comes up at the very end of the 1940s, the French government is vehemently opposed. But how it works in terms of creating regional offices is that only members of that region whose seat of government is in the region are allowed to vote on whether or not they want a regional office. So even though Britain, France, Belgium are all going to be full members of an Africa region if it's created, the only members that are allowed to vote on whether or not they want the office are Liberia and South Africa. So the French use sort of all their tools in their diplomatic toolkit to shut this down. They ultimately fail. Both Liberia and South Africa want the Africa office. And so then this is where they come up with this idea that, you know, if we can't stop it from coming to Africa, let's put it in Brazzaville so we can at least kind of watch over what the office is doing. Okay, so that's sort of the first group of outsiders. So thinking about French colonial doctors as outsiders at the WHO. And then I want to say a few words about thinking about the WHO as an outsider in French Africa. So after some really intense debates, not everyone in the French colonial administration agreed with this position that the WHO office should come to Brazzaville. And actually, it's interesting, it was doctors on the ground that were more vehemently opposed to having the office there. They said, you know, put it in Kampala, put it somewhere else, like keep it as far away from us as humanly possible. And it's really officials in Paris who are pushing for putting this in Brazzaville so that they can establish some sort of oversight over the office. So they end up inviting the office to set up in Brazzaville. This is a time when other regional offices are moving forward with very concrete plans to launch different eradication campaigns, develop infant and maternal health services, advise member states on expanding their sanitation services. The WHO office in Africa isn't doing much of anything. And so if you actually just look at the annual reports, of all the regional offices, I always do this activity with my students where I assign them each a different region and I print off the pages from the annual report. And I think in like 1952, there may be two pages from Africa. And you know, if you look at like the Eastern Mediterranean Regional Office, it's like a 25-page report. And I have them all come up and say like what each of their offices did this year. And we talk about, you know, why is nothing happening in Africa? They spend most of the year bickering about various political issues. So whether or not Brazzaville is even suited to host a regional headquarters of a major international organization is sort of the main gist of what they're fighting about. And what I argue in the book is that this battle really highlights the question of compatibility between an older imperial vision of the world and a new post-war vision in which many of these tasks that fall under the umbrella of development now fall not to colonial governments, but to new international organizations like the WHO, the UN Food and Agriculture Organization, and UNICEF. So I argue that while the French ultimately fail in their efforts to keep the WHO and other UN agencies out of Africa, they do succeed in drastically limiting the capacity of the WHO to enact its agenda on the African continent. So political debates about empire at the UN had the unintended consequence of constraining the possibilities for truly global health action in Africa prior to decolonization. And as I said, this is, of course, one of the regions of the world that's perhaps most in need of some of the services that the WHO aimed to provide. So some of the other arguments they're having are about the cost of living for international personnel. Living costs in Brazzaville are extremely high. Accusations about colonial racism and squabbles about whether or not the organization is allowed to directly interface with Africans. So there's a whole 3-year debate about whether or not they can have a public relations officer. Because God forbid someone from an international organization actually talk to people on the ground. So this becomes this whole thing. So colonial officials had been hopeful in the aftermath of the war that health was the one area of colonial rule in which the French could demonstrate an uninterrupted record of real commitment to development. But the arrival of an international health organization on French African soil threatened to expose the French Empire to an unprecedented level of international criticism, whose force, once unleashed, they feared would be impossible to contain. So although French officials ultimately managed to succeed in quelling international concerns about Brazzaville's shortcomings, tensions between the French administration and the international personnel that came to work there set a really unfortunate precedent for the relationship between the French Empire and the UN more generally. Okay. So even as the WHO established itself in the heart of France's empire in sub-Saharan Africa, in many ways it remained an outsider. And then I'll just finish by saying a little bit about you know, if I could write an email to myself 7 years ago, I would have told myself, I think, to do this research in a little bit different way. I think that there's a really interesting question that I don't think I can answer, but if I was going to start it over, I maybe would have done this slightly differently, and that's how did this actually impact the health of Africans, right? So is there a way to sort of parse out, you know, did eradication campaigns in Africa have a different actual health income for, health outcome for Africans as a result of this tension? And that's something that if anyone has ideas of how that could be incorporated a bit more into the book, I would be really excited to hear. And I will wrap up.
Great. Thanks. Thank you.